Bachelor of Arts production.
Welcome to episode number 53 of the Supporting Act podcast. This week on the show, I sit down with Canadian singer-songwriter Hoxley Workman, and Larissa Music stops by to recommend a song for this week's featured song of the week. Stay tuned, you might learn something. Welcome to episode number 53 of the Supporting Act podcast. My name is Matt Moskal. I'll be your host. I'm a musician by trade, a journalist by education, and I like to frame pictures of other people's families. That was creepy, wasn't it?
A little bit.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, I see mine up here, actually.
Yeah.
Is that my grandma?
Yeah. If you're unfamiliar with the show, this is an independently produced podcast that is brought to you every week on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Liberated Syndication, as well as on showbizmonkeys.com, Tumblr, and on 101.5 UMFM every midnight, every Sunday at midnight. You can also listen to the show streaming online Sundays at midnight on umfm.com. This week on the show, I will be joined by Hoxley Workman, famed Canadian musician. He and I talked over the phone from the UMFM studio. But before we get there, we're going to go back to the new feature on the show here. We're going to ease into this new feature with another guest on the program. It's the featured song of the week, and my guest at this time is Miss Larissa Music, otherwise known as Citadel. How are you doing?
I'm great. Hi, everyone. We're going to introduce a new upcoming band in Winnipeg called Mabel's Flight. They have a song out called King of Spain. You can find it on SoundCloud or YouTube. And, my name is Citadel. It's new. It's spelled with a Y. It's
Why is it Citadel with a Y?
It's Citadel with a Y because, well, my last name is Music, and I thought that was kind of awkward to release music under the last name Music, so I changed it. And I liked Citadel because Citadel is supposedly the meaning of Larissa, and my name is spelt with a Y, not with an I, which is the traditional spelling, and Citadel is spelt with an I and not with a Y traditionally, so that's why I made that change.
Well, I never picked up on the fact that it correlates perfectly with your first name.
Yeah, well, perfect is it's a stretch, but yeah, well, it works.
It's functioning. It works. It's doing what it has to do. That's the point.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're gigging about town yourself as well, right?
Yeah, so we're starting out a little bit here. So on Saturday, the 20th of December, I will be at Winnipeg's Maker and Market. So that will be at 1 p.m. I'll be there with some other artists, including Carrie J. Buss and a few others. And then in the evening, I'll be opening for a gentleman called Darren Baldwin. And he'll be playing there with his band, and that will be at about 7. So... And that'll be at
318 Ross, right?
Yes. So that's at 318 Ross is Makers and Markets. So that's Frame Arts Warehouse. And then in the evening, it's Sam's Place.
Okay. I like Sam's Place. It's a very quaint little venue.
It is. I love the lizard.
Yeah, the big lizard on stage.
When I saw that, I freaked.
Yeah. When I was playing, I put the boot, because they do pay what you can, I put the boot right near the lizard's jaws. And I was like, you know, put in money if you dare kind of thing. And then no one put money in, so.
Oh, I had a nice chat with him.
Did you?
Yeah, people looked at me funny. I don't know why. I don't know.
Did you actually talk to him on the stage?
No. Okay.
There was a psychic connection then.
Yeah, there was a psychic connection. I have a sixth sense.
For speaking to lizards?
Yeah.
You're like Harry Potter.
Yeah, or Eddie Murphy in...
Dr. Doolittle?
Yeah, Dr. Doolittle.
Yeah, I like that. That's the version of Dr. Doolittle. Dr. Doolittle, wow.
Litter. Doctor, I do litter.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense because it's animals, right?
Yeah, no, actually
right?
That's...
Cats.
That I'm surprised that wasn't his name, actually, Dr. Doolittle, you know?
Yeah.
Scorned his whole life for having a last name that makes him sound like he should be cleaning up cat feces, but secretly having a psychic connection with all the felines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
I really like that. I think we should change it. Should make a sequel called Dr. Doolittle.
Yeah.
Just all about cats. I love cats. I love cats. That'd be so fun.
So Citadel will be performing as well with me on the 19th of December at Le Garage Cafe in the St. Boniface area of Winnipeg, Manitoba, along with the band Finn, who I had on the show for episode 51. That'll be a fun gig. Apparently their CD release show is packed, so hopefully there's a good crowd for this one as well. Also, let's talk a little bit about Mabel's Flight. Let's talk about this, the song that you've recommended. You said you know some of Mabel's Flight?
I do. I know Cameron Cannon pretty well. The rest of the members I'm still getting acquainted with, but they're working on their album at home at a at-home studio, and it's going very well. They should be coming up with some new singles released on SoundCloud again. And as far as an album release, we're still waiting on that. It's kind of mysterious, but yeah, they're very interesting. Their sound is very, it resonates with me, so I think it will resonate with others.
Excellent. Well, let's get resonating. I'm now going to play King of Spain by Mabel's Flight.
In my dream, I was the King of Spain, and every man I met, he knew my name. And people would hang on every word I'd say. Life was good, I knew no shame, and the maiden's lips all bore my name. No man dared challenge me in my game. I'm just a poor boy from the plains, nothing good from here except the grain. I'm just a poor boy from the plains. I want to be the king of Spain. Wake up wishing to be far from here, my throne advisors in my ear, deciding the fate of a man that I'll never know. Watch my hills of green and gold grow in beauty as I grow old. Such is the life that I'll never know. I'm just a poor good from here except the grain. I'm just a poor boy from the plains. I wanna be the king of Spain.
That's Mabel's Flight with King of Spain. For more Mabel's Flight, visit www.facebook.com/Mabel's Flight, or you can follow them on Twitter at Mabel's Flight. Thank you so much to Larissa Music, otherwise known as Citadel, for recommending that song. You can check out her music on facebook.com/Citadel Music. Citadel is spelt with a Y, or you can follow her on Twitter at Citadel Music. In a lot of ways, it's been leading up to this. My guest this week on The Supporting Act is Hoxley Workman, Canadian singer-songwriter. If you have not heard the first episode of this series, we have been building up to this interview since the start of this podcast. In our first episode, we talked to Melanie Dolling about a show she had written about how the song you're hearing in the background, Striptease by Hoxley Workman, had helped awaken something in her emotionally, sexually, spiritually, what have you. And the song remains the same for so many people that I know that are dedicated Hoxley Workman fans. They all started out at a young age, seeing this music video, and then buying a copy of Hoxley's 2001 record, Last Night We Wore the Delicious Wolves, and then being pleasantly surprised by the versatility that was within it.
Wash the dishes, wash the dishes, the Christmas dinner dishes, 3 generations in the kitchen, all at once.
Now, Hoxley has released over a dozen albums, and one that particularly stands out for me is his Christmas record, Almost a Full Moon, that was released back in 2001 with Last Night We Were the Delicious Wolves. Now, everyone has that cool family member that helped turn them on to the music that defines their youth, and for me it was my cousin Laura, who gave me a copy of the Hoxley Workman Christmas album, and it really turned me on to how something that could be so fun and original could be associated with something as reviled as Christmas music is in some circles, you know? Most people hate all Christmas music that isn't like the Vince Guaraldi, you know, music from the Charlie Brown Christmas special, you know? Michael Bublé's Christmas album, every year I read Facebook status after Facebook status about how much people hate it. But there was something different about Hoxley's Almost a Full Moon. And I was hooked. I became a fan.
Baby, you're drunk and acting tough. I know you're sad, you're not the only one who feels like that now. And maybe anger is your only choice. But maybe heart and fist and human voice might be the better way.
Now, my own personal fandom aside, Hoxley Workman has been someone that has been consistently putting out records year after year since the year 2000. He's ventured into so many different genres, whether it be dance music, pop music, a lot of what they call indie rock these days, as well as there's an entire record that's full of just acoustic folk-inspired material. He's really covered a lot of ground in the time he's been working, and his discography is a treasury of just interesting songs that that seem like they could be huge on the radio, but there's just something missing. There's just something that hasn't happened over the years. He's remained this cult-like figure. He's had this status that, as we said in our first episode in Winnipeg, if you like Phantom of the Paradise or Hoxley Workman, you're probably from here.
When these mountains were the seashore, when this desert was the ocean floor, we would swim beneath the star-filled sky. We were lovely fish alone in the night.
So on this week's show, when I found out that Hoxley was coming to town with one of his newer music projects, I decided to reach out to him finally, and his management were awesome. Everybody at Isadora Records were great, and I got to call Hoxley from the UMFM studio, which we thought for a moment had caught fire before the interview started, but you know, he was cool with waiting around for us to make sure that everyone was safe and alive. He set aside a good period of time to chat, and we didn't talk so much about his career so much as we just kind of got into opinion. I was very excited to talk to the guy, as you can probably imagine. So a lot of this conversation, it bounces around a lot. It goes places that don't really have any form or structure, but I still feel it was worth publishing because I think that this is just a really interesting insight into the mental process and even just the well-being of somebody as eccentric and interesting and entertaining as Hoxley Workman is. So thank you for tuning into this week's show. You can email us at tsapodcast@gmail.com. Follow us at tsapod on Twitter or find us on Facebook at the Supporting Act Podcast. But before you do, please enjoy my interview with Hoxley Workman.
Thank you.
I always find these phone situations a little awkward. I feel like I'm doing the news or something, and I've got you out there doing the traffic report right now, you know?
Well, I'm happy to give you the traffic report here in Edmonton. I can see right through over the valley. If you want the up-to-date on the bridge situation, I'm your number one go-to.
Excellent. Yeah. What is the situation out there? How is the...
Things look fluid here in Edmonton. Absolutely fluid. I don't see any problems. I've been up since 5:30 this morning because I'm a morning person, so I watch the roads, and definitely it gets heavy between 7 and 8:30, but you know, things are really calm right now. So if you're making the trip across the river here in Edmonton, you're in good shape.
All right. Excellent. And now back to sports. I've noticed with the stuff you've been writing over the years, there's such a great degree of theatrics in it. And I find that, like, I don't meet a lot of theater students these days who haven't heard your music or aren't fans already. Were you a big theater guy growing up?
I mean, I was pretty lucky. I grew up in the United Church of Canada, and one of the ministers that came through our church was like a theater fanatic, and he loved to put on musicals, and he also loved British comedy, so we did a lot of that. But, you know, which is to say, I was active in, you know, local theater when I was a kid and had lots of exposure to it. You know, whether that, you know, had a lasting impact, I'm not sure, but because certainly, you know, thereafter, I'm not a theater guy. I sort of feel like I tend to be the least cultured guy in a room. So, you know, it just feels like an instinct to me. I think also, I have a horribly, you know, short attention span for things, and particularly myself. So I sort of feel like maybe some of the theatrical stuff is there in some ways to kind of make it feel like I'm working and keeping people interested and keeping myself interested. So I've been asked that a few times lately, and I've given it a bit of thought because it just feels like a natural instinct, performance instinct for me. Like, and I think too, I tend to require a lot as a listener or as an audience member. I tend to leave shows feeling sometimes a little underwhelmed. You know, and I think I'm a terrible person to have be a fan, you know, like I demand quite a bit. And I sort of feel like that's what informs my instinct.
Well, naturally, like, I mean, there's, do you, well, first of all, like, naturally the instinct, to incorporate covers in sort of original compositions. I mean, is that what the short attention span sort of resulted in? Was doing a translation, like medleying, one of your songs into a popular song as well that gets played on the radio?
Like, you're referring to when I do that in concerts and stuff?
Yes, of course, yes. You know.
Yeah, well, it's funny, like, I think when I was a teenager, I was a music teacher in my small town, like, and I taught private lessons on drums and piano and guitar, and most of my students were kids who had a natural musical aptitude, but who had suffered through the grind of the conservatory system, and had kind of come out the other end a little disenchanted, and so they would come to me, their parents would say, so, you know, my sort of style of teaching was a bit like, well, how about we learn to really like music? And within a few lessons back then, like, most kids wanted to learn Time of My Life by those guys.
Green Day?
Yeah, Green Day.
Yeah.
And so, and you know, after a handful of lessons, and this kid is playing a song that he or she really likes, like, all of a sudden music is somehow demystified, which is not to say that there's not something eternally mystical about music, because there is, and that's why it's so important to our souls. But I sort of feel like, and I think when I'm on stage, like, the artiste, quote unquote, the liberal elite artiste who it's, you know, it's so easy to kind of indict, especially now politically, we're a favorite target of all sorts of people. I think what it is for me is it's showing fluidity and natural accidentalism of music. Like, if you're a music fan, music is this thing that is, it's layered, it's like a light unto itself. Once you plug into it, it's eternal, like I said, and I sort of feel like it's nice to debunk things, because it makes me a little bit uncomfortable when you talk in sort of elevated terms about music, which is, again, not to say that it ought not to be spoken of in elevated terms, but it is nice to sort of democratize those things and to sort of bring it back and humanize it. And I think that's sort of what I've always done. It's been part of my instinct and mode of thinking is to invite language, simpler language, but also cumbersome language, language that you don't often hear in pop music. And then I guess when I intermingle with other songs, it's also there to show maybe what a music fan I am. And I grew up in such an exceedingly musical household with my dad basically DJing all our waking hours as kids. There was music on constantly. So maybe too, music lives in a bit of a chaotic mosaic for me. So if I'm in the middle of one of my own songs, it's nice to head off the road and try something else out. And I think too, going back to my music lesson thing, kids are astonished that most pop music is written with five chords, you know. Yeah. And those five chords, again, that's the fabric that's kind of, it's interesting to kind of move the kaleidoscope a little bit when you're like, oh man, like I remember, and then sometimes I do it just for a laugh. Like I remember when I was in Norway one time, I dropped The Sun Always Shines on TV from Aha, and like the place goes ape. And I think that's, you know, it's that again for me was almost like a cultural intermingling, you know, and like I'm here in your country, but your country was a part of my musical atmosphere in the 80s, and here's proof of it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and there's this whole argument people have all the time where, you know, there's, when you find out that a song, for example, like, the one recently that I recall is like Sam Smith's Stay With Me has a similar, like structure in terms of chorus to Won't Back Down by Tom Petty. I mean, they're in a different key, but apparently if you change the key, it matches perfectly or something. And people mm-hmm. say like all the original ideas have been taken. Well, I think that's kind of the opposite of the truth. It's that everything is connected and it all exists. It's like I Heart Huckabees. It's all under the blanket and then it's all connected, which makes it both remarkable and seem unremarkable at the same time, right?
Yeah, well, there you hit it. Like that duality is in some ways is the magic actualized. You know, it's like, it's the fact that you can sort of approach music and it looks like such a conundrum hanging on the horizon. I think that you've just nailed it. I'm absolutely with you.
Yeah, I just think it's an astounding practice. And I mean, do you remember, like, obviously the music lessons is a big part of it, but do you remember, like, at what point, you know, that sort of, web that you weave, that sort of, aspect of the live show started to become, prominent? Or is it something that's been with you for a long time, like, since the music lessons?
You mean, like, the theatrical side of things, or?
Oh, I guess it's an all-encompassing kind of question. I guess I'm referring to sort of the covers being incorporated into things. I'm always...
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the thing about music is one of the elements of music in the entertainment business that I get tired of is that, you know, music has always been used as a way... It's a community builder.
Yeah.
Like it or not, and in some ways, like, I've always sort of just been drawn to music I like. And in high school, maybe I was a bit lucky that I didn't feel like I needed a band to be on my t-shirt necessarily in order to sort of to establish my tribal belonging, you know? So
yeah.
In high school, when grunge was kind of happening, I was more into fusion jazz and other kind of stuff. And I guess, I'm not being very succinct here, but
that's okay. It's
but we all, in some ways, like want to expose the richness of our, you know, of our musical backgrounds to expose what it is that, you know, it's a mode of thinking. You know, like it's like if you wear a Ramones shirt in high school, like then people sort of can already tick a few boxes as to who, what kind of person you might be. At least that's in the high school person's frame of thinking. That's what they're thinking, you know, like,
yeah.
You know, I did used to wear Jimi Hendrix t-shirt or a Bauhaus t-shirt, and I thought it sort of said something about myself. And so I think when I'm on stage, especially too, because I've realized through the years that when critics are sort of, you know, in their own minds listing off the who they think are sort of my probable influences, they're usually not quite on, you know.
Yeah,
I wasn't really influenced so much by David Bowie. I wasn't influenced by Jeff Buckley. These are the ones that I used to get all the time when I was younger. And so I think, too, it's nice to kind of air out the, you know, who really was there, you know? Like, I was more into Thomas Dolby. I was more into the Smiths. I was more into Bruce Coburn, you know? And it's fun for me to, I'm also a pop music fan, as was my dad, you know? And when I talk about DJing, my dad wasn't really into listening to albums. He was into listening to singles. And really, I've inherited that from him also. You know, the album has to be, it has to be excruciating for me to like really, really invite it into my life. I'd rather hear a very inventive single. Like, I was just out for a run and I was listening to the new Mother, Monkey Tree. And it's like, I think that kid Ryan Guildmont is a pretty clever kid. And like, to me, when you come up with, whenever I hear a melody that's truly like, that truly excites me, like, it's a big deal. So I'll play that record on spin or on, what do you call it, on repeat. And like, it's like, oh, that's nice to hear somebody who's like taking a pop structure and still like stretching the limitations of melody. Because melody only has two directions, right? It only goes up and down. Like, it's not like we're dealing with a three-dimensional moving object here. Like, and so considering that it is a sort of, it has a two-dimensional movement, except of course the additional aspect of the singer's expression, then that kind of creates the three-dimensional or if not four-dimensional element. So just from a pragmatic sort of almost structural, as if like from one cabinet maker to another, I look at Ryan Guildmont as a cabinet maker. I think that's how you pronounce his name. And it's like, wow, that guy's cabinets are pretty bloody cool, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm just judging it from one cabinet maker to another, you know?
Yeah. And like, there's a phrase that gets tossed around in our culture as well, the guilty pleasure, that like when you're listening to something that is commercially popular, you know, there are aspects of it that can feel tacky. Now, Mother, of course, like they packed the entire Burton Cummings theater here, and certainly wouldn't consider them tacky or anything like that. But there's something to pop music that people have this association, like this guilty pleasure, this concept of something that is manufactured and sounds manufactured, and therefore they sort of repel it, but they don't realize, like, for example, Buck 65 with Super Pretty Naughty recently created something that was extremely radio friendly and done in sort of a vein that's meant to sort of shake hands with a side of songwriting that he hasn't embraced, that takes that polished quality, and while it might sound like it's a mockery of it, it's actually embracing it. I mean, when you talk about being a fan of pop music, do you believe in guilty pleasures? Do you think that's something that our culture should reflect on, or do you think it actually exists?
I think guilty pleasure is a colloquial for people who are sort of insecure in their own sort of musical taste. Like, I don't buy into the very concept of guilty pleasure. Like, to me, it's colloquially uninteresting to me. Like, if I like something, I'll like it. Like, I have no guilt about it. And, you know, like, I remember when I landed in Switzerland one time years ago, and I turned on MTV because I couldn't sleep, and the first single from the Justin Timberlake record came out, and it was that one, it's just an acoustic guitar and a backbeat.
Yeah.
And it was just like, holy shit, what is this? Like, if I'm devastated by music, I'm devastated by music. It's like, I don't need to justify it to my friends, you know, in terms of it being like a guilty pleasure or not. To me, if something's great, it's great. It's undeniable. If something's not great, then it sort of resides in the not great column for me forever. And I think I'd be more guilty if I was like trying to like slum it and pretend to enjoy something that wasn't particularly good, you know?
Yeah, like to force yourself to listen to a record by, say, like a band that you enjoy their body of work at certain points, but then after a while it sort of becomes like old hat. They're kind of phoning it in. I think that would be considered a guiltier pleasure, in that you like it almost because you have faith that they're going to do something great again, but you're not necessarily, you know, tuned into what they're currently doing.
Yeah, that's funny, because I'm of two minds in that one. The big one comes to mind at U2, which U2 really needs a rethink, and I'm a big fan.
Yeah.
But the other side of things is that in sort of the European mindset, a loyalty to an artist is kind of embraced with a lot more severity. You know, we're sort of informed by that catty British instinct to, like, once an artist stumbles once, he's out of the club forever, you know? Like, I've never really been like that, and I guess I've sort of developed and understood that relationship with artists with my sort of my devotion to Bruce Cockburn. And so over the 30 some odd records he's released, there's been some I've loved and some I haven't. And now, as an artist who has 15 or whatever records under my belt, I realize that, you know, you're always out with a keen instinct to make something great, but greatness requires an intangible, an X factor, and it's not always there. And so all of this to say that if you buy into an artist, it's almost a commitment of faith, and that in that commitment, you should be there to still at least be taking in the message, whether it's for you or not. Like, it's, to me, it's a long-term relationship, and this sort of, this, like I said, this catty sort of British thing, the way we sort of glibly deal with artists who, if they briefly stumble, you know, that, you know, they're never to be listened to again. But that's sort of music as harbinger of fashion, and unfortunately a great deal of the way that the music entertainment business works, and the way that, you know, even some music criticism, especially out of the UK, is all they're really doing is commenting on fashion. They're not really commenting on anything else.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Supporting Act podcast, episode number 53, with Hawksley Workman, either online or on 101.5 UMFM. I'm just going to play you a bit of a track from Hawksley's latest project called The Mounties, that features members of Hot Hot Heat and Limb Lifter.
I was going to say, like, one of the most fascinating stories I remember from seeing you in concert years ago was one of the songs that hooked me into your body of work. You prefaced it on stage by saying that this was a song that people told you was not going to do well as a single, and it turned out to be "We'll Still Need a Song," which is still a song that I cover as a musician, and a song that I just adore. And I think it's interesting that you would take what was posed to you as what could be a career misstep, and you made it something absolutely gorgeous and endearing. How do you handle other people's sort of insight or professional opinions on your body of work? Do you take criticism well, or?
Well, firstly, I'm geeked to hear that you sing that song. It's amazing, and I'm also super grateful for such a clever chat with you. So, but anyway, so to fast forward, you know, I'm going to be 40 in March.
Yeah,
and you know, I've published a book, and I've written a play, and I started this new band, and I've put out all these records and toured, and that can all add up to being a jaded guy, and that can all add up to being a lot of things. But I think ultimately for me, I have a better understanding of who I am as the human animal, and I'm very affected by people's opinions. But at the end of the day, I'm so not intellectually driven, insofar as I don't sit with a list of pros and cons before I make any decisions. I'm so guttural in the way I operate that even if I was to seek to please somebody, in the end, my body always wins out. In the end, my body always does what it pleases. You know, so it's a funny thing that, I just realized that my instinct tends to own, it's an almost complete ownership of who I am. And so, there were years where definitely were, you know, agents and management and people who were working for me, they all believed I should have been a much bigger star than I was. And, you know, they would give me advice, like, well, you should do this and you should do that. And they were doing it from a place of great care and that they wanted my thing to succeed. And, but it would seem like I think they would think that I just wasn't listening. And that wasn't the case. The fact is that my musical instinct is something that lives in my body. It lives in my cells. It doesn't really live in my brain. My brain just gets in the way, you know. Music for me happens below the shoulders, and whenever the guy who lives in the penthouse starts to weigh in, things start to turn south, you know? So all that to say is that I hear people. I was raised as a people pleaser, you know, like my parents yeah. liked that I got good marks in school and stuff like that. But ultimately, I have a more rebel spirit, and it's not for any aesthetic pursuit at all. It's just that my body does all the thinking in my life. For the most part, I'm kind of just a slobbering bear, you know?
No, I feel you. There are definitely days where, one of the things I loved about, theater classes or improv classes I've taken is they say when you enter a scene, enter with a certain body part. I mean, I always wonder when watching a musician, like, which body part they're entering with. And it kind of sounds like you're walking into it just not even head first, just whole body first. It's that last verse of the Hokey Pokey or something.
Yeah.
You put your whole self in.
I think you're dead on. I feel that way. Like, you know, I sort of feel my job is to just puke it out, you know, like, and that's the feeling when I'm on stage is that, like, it's just so guttural for me. And I just kind of get on the ride and go, you know, like, yeah. I feel like I am only, you know, consciously a very distant, you know, tertiary participant. I sort of feel like I watch my body go and just ram against things, you know. It's a very odd feeling, really.
Yeah. Well, there's things about, like, I took a very odd psychology course years ago about how there's some people who function on a higher level that, they maybe have something to do with the ego, but they mentally operate outside of their own body in a way. Like, they said they're always 3 feet behind them and a couple feet in the air behind themselves. Is that sort of what you're feeling on stage? Is that you're sort of, it's like you're there's a whole idea of like the genius being separate from the physical being. Like, the genius is like writing this opera for the physical being to perform, and the physical being is sort of just a puppet to the mental process.
Well, man, that's a lot of big thoughts there.
I'm sorry. I've had these questions for you for years, man.
Yeah, that gets really cool.
Yeah.
You know, maybe this is because I feel like I've been totally taken apart and put back together again by this new Bruce Coburn memoir, and maybe it's a lot of his language around the central desire in humans to commune with the divine. And I think for me, like, that's all it is. My greatest understanding of divinity, or the closest thing I have to it, is a place where there's no existence of time. And that is either in performance of music or running, to be honest with you. Those are the two things that I find that closeness with divinity sort of takes place. And which is not to say that what I'm doing, you know, has any, you know, regal Christian benefit or anything like that, or benefit for any other religion for that matter, only that, like, for me, it's a place without pain. It's a place without future. It's a place without past. It's a place without memory. And it's about as pure as I know how to be. But it's still, I just get on the ride and go. I don't feel personally responsible for it. I feel like I'm a conduit for it. And I just feel like I trained my body in such a way for so many years as a kid, you know, from starting really practicing with a real focus at such a young age, that for some reason it was like this training brought me a level of proficiency. And then all I had to do was, like, kind of open myself for the spirit to kind of move through, you know. And I sometimes when I'm playing music, it's like, man, I can't remember how I even got to this place. Like, how is it that my body knows how to do all this stuff? Like,
yeah.
I don't, I don't sit around thinking about music. Like, I don't sit very often thinking, like, geez, it would be cool if I tried a song that, you know, had a few more minor chords in it or whatever. Like, my body, like I said, it's so cellular for me that I sometimes don't, and I don't have a real, you know, relevant grasp on some of its maybe more delicate features, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. But that's, I think that's a sign that you just become truly great at something, is just that feeling of like, you no longer second guess certain things. They just come out of you. Like, I'm like that with seventh chords right now. Like, I can't help but just throw one into everything.
Right.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about running, actually, because I really, am fascinated by, musicians and artists, running and exercise. I remember, there's sort of a documentary out there, I guess. I don't know if it's complete or not, but it's about, the band Bon Iver having like an exercise ritual every morning, and how like physical, sort of activity and sort of having a regiment has helped them sort of, carry on through their career. Has running always been the ritual for you, and was it a response to sort of the lifestyle of being a musician that running became a part of it, or is it just a personal thing that came into your life?
It's definitely multi-layered. Running, again, like I said, is spiritual, that when you hit typically at about a half an hour, you sort of leave your body and things become very pure.
Yeah.
I started running because, like, the archetypal body shape of a rock star is supposed to be skinny. And being, you know, born in northern rural Ontario, I have a body of somebody who's supposed to push cars out of snowbanks, you know? So I just, you know, my vanity and my understanding of the business is that people want to hear songs come from a skinny guy, you know? And so, but that was maybe just the beginning. Once you get into running and once you have a relationship with it, you understand that your body listens a lot to the lies your brain tells. And, if, you know, I tend to run 8K at a time. And so,
wow.
You know, and for lots of people who don't run, 8 kilometers sounds like a real long distance, but that's just your brain convincing your body that it's not possible to do. And really, it's entirely possible to do. I have a lot of energy to spend in the day. I have a very hard time sleeping as well. And I find that if I don't exercise, I lose that. I also like feeling high, which is why I like to drink a lot of wine. And for me, the best drugs you can do in the daytime is go running, you know? And
yeah.
I remember seeing a documentary on Bob Marley, who liked Bon Iver. Part of his Rastafarian regime with his band was to smoke up and go running, because if you smoked up and opened a bag of Cheetos, like, nothing to get done. But if you smoke up and go running, all of a sudden, the divinity contained within that herb becomes it intertwined with the movement of your blood and the circulation and your oxygen. And so all of a sudden, like, it's almost like a sacrament, you know? And I guess I sort of feel like my body is there to be used, and I certainly abused it well enough. I sort of feel like I should be giving something back. So it's a lot of fronts. I find too that with my, you know, I'm in a constant state of having to negotiate my inner loathing and my inner and my anger and my sadness. And so I find that, like, running basically can eclipse that, if only momentarily. But even a momentary break from it is like something you'd spend thousands of dollars on, you know, if they were selling it at the store.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say too, one of the sort of visuals I think people associate with a touring musician is, and I see a lot of this interviewing a lot of touring musicians as well, is like, you know, the day of the show is a busy day. You get up, maybe there's, you know, there's a lot of travel involved, there's a rehearsal involved, there's maybe going and getting food. I mean, all this stuff takes so much time, there's barely any, it feels like there's barely any me time in there, right? It's like sometimes you're crammed in a van with people and it's this sweaty ritual that can feel really uncomfortable. So do you think running is sort of also a response to, like, some of the best advice I've heard given to stand-up comedians is have a life outside of comedy. Do you think that running is sort of also having a life outside of music that helps center you in terms of getting in touch, especially with, like, the place that you're in? Like, if you're in Edmonton, you know, you have a favorite place to run there, you know?
It's funny. I don't have an outdoor running, outlet in Edmonton, but what you said is absolutely true. Like in Victoria, I have favorite place to run. In Vancouver, I have favorite places to run. In Toronto, I have favorite places to run. In Montreal, I have favorite places to run. And that is true. It is a nice way to take in a city. It's a nice way to, like, I mean, there's a running culture in almost any city you go to, and you can see that running culture shift, like this sort of new phenomenon of running to and from work. I started to see in the UK, like about 5 or 6 years ago, and it's starting to seem a bit fashionable here now. And definitely, like, the archetypal rock star is supposed to be eternally skinny. He's supposed to look effortless, and he's supposed to be destroying himself for our cathartic pleasure. And so I think the idea of a rock star running is kind of like, well, hold it a second here. That's not how it's supposed to go. That the archetypal rock star is effortlessly thin, like the Thin White Duke, you know, or Iggy Pop or something like that. Reality is that there's some great music being made by people whose body shapes don't conform to, you know, to the archetype. And so, and then too, like the boozy, druggy, you know, musician is another sort of archetype we like. And like I said, that sort of goes into that catharsis that the public wants to see. They want to see somebody destroy themselves, because it serves something in our mythology. And if somebody's doing it on our behalf, then we don't have to do it ourselves. But I just think that the running thing is, for a lot of people on the road, like you say, it helps you get around a city and get a good look at it. But it's a momentary bit of sanity. And then once you are through a run, it gives you more energy. It gives you more clarity. It gives you more. I find that I can sing way better as a runner, too. Like, you know, my voice is always pretty good, but if I'm in a kick where I'm really hot on doing, like, you know, 40 plus K a week, I can kind of sing whatever you want me to sing, you know? It's just that physical power is there.
Amazing. And yeah, and it's kind of interesting. Too, you mentioned, like, this momentary sanity. I mean, a lot of the time, there's a lot of conversations that are being had about this concept about, well, for example, like a Rolling Stone article I read about Larry David and how he had an entire stadium full of people stand up and cheer for him when the camera went on him and put him on the Jumbotron. And then he's leaving the stadium and someone yells out of a car, "Hey, Larry, you suck." And he spent the rest of the night transfixed on that one person yelling, "You suck," and not the thousands of people standing on their feet and cheering for him.
Right.
So that momentary sanity kind of flips that concept and takes basically what could be a relatively horrible day. It puts it in perspective, because in that one moment you had sanity. You reached a point where you weren't overthinking anything, or you felt completely in touch, with where you were. When you run, do you have a set path, or do you just sort of make it up as you go?
Depends on what city I'm in and how well I know it. I don't like feeling lost, that's for sure. I always run with, like, some of the local currency in my pocket, a credit card and my driver's license, just because, like, you know, sometimes, like, if you're running in Paris, you never know if you're going to be able to remember exactly how you got to where you're going. So, but
do people ever, like, recognize and, like, you know, yell things at you while you're running, or are they ever like, "There he goes"?
Only occasionally. I'm not on TV as much as I used to be, so I'm not recognized in the way I used to be. Like when Striptease was on Much Music, people used to recognize me more. So I don't really get a lot of that, but occasionally, like, and I think, you know, people will say, like, I'll see you on Twitter sometimes and be like, "I think I just ran past Hoxie Workman in the park." And it's like, yeah, you probably did, you know?
That's funny. Oh man. I want to talk a bit about the new band. I know we've kind of gone over half an hour here, but I just kind of want to.
That's okay. I've only got a few more minutes because I've got a private tour of the McDonald Hotel here in Edmonton scheduled. But okay, go ahead.
Okay, just really quickly, I want to just talk quick about the new band. I'm really fascinated by this group because, for example, like a lot of the music videos I see of you are all like one take videos, and then this new group, it feels like it's a lot of like collage sort of artwork and everything. I don't know why I was fixated on that point, but Basically, what is Mounties to you as a creative being who's carried yourself as this solo showman for so long?
Mounties is the greatest breath of fresh air I think I've ever had. You know, I think it's put a bounce in my step that hasn't gone away in 2 years. And I think too, like when you meet people who become great friends and these great collaborators, I'm just really, really, really grateful for it. It's given me such an immense, feeling of power, I think creative power. And I feel like I'm siphoning it into my own music. And yeah, it's the gift that is Mounties is something that just keeps on giving. Like it keeps sort of morphing and creating new things that I love about it. And two, like drums was always my first instrument. Like drums was the instrument that at 10 years old, I decided I was going to get great at and started practicing hours and hours and hours a day, which I did for a decade, practice, you know, 3, 4, 5 hours a day. And so I was a bit derailed with the whole solo project thing. And so I think too, for Mounties, like again, going back to full circle to this whole body thing, my body is doing basically what I built it to do, which is play the drums.
Wow. Okay, and one more quick question. I'm really sorry to do this, but all right. I like to end the show off with recommendations to listeners, things that they can check out from the lips of the people I'm interviewing to their ears. And in your case, you talked about being you know, in the church and how you were brought up with sort of British comedies and musicals. That really stood out to me. Is there like a British comedy that you recommend if you're still big into the British comedy, or is there one that was seminal?
Well, nothing like on a theatrical front. Obviously, you know, I worship Ricky Gervais, just because he's plugged into something so wild. But I can't, you know, Mounties Band are big comedy fans. We love Kyle Mooney. We love Dr. Steve Brule. Those are sort of two on heavy rotation for us. Those aren't British comedies, but that's all I can think of on the comedy front off the top of my head.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, have you seen Life's Too Short with Warwick Davis?
No.
Okay, I'm going to recommend that to you. It's Ricky and Stephen Merchant are behind that one, and it's Warwick. It's a one series long British show, and there's a great scene with Liam Neeson doing comedy improv. It's phenomenal. I won't spoil it for you.
Okay.
All right.
Sounds good, though.
All right, excellent. Thank you so much for doing the show. This has been a great chat, and I look forward to your performance.
It has been a great chat. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
No problem. Cheers, and have a great day.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
It's nice to meet you. I know what you've been through, because I have been there, too. Tell me your secrets. I promise to keep.
So thank you so much for tuning into this week's show. Thank you so much to Hawksley Workman for being my guest. You can find him online at Hawksley Workman on Twitter, or just look up hawksleyworkman.com. You can also check out his newest project with Steve Bays from Hot Hot Heat and Ryan Dahl from Limlifter. They're called Mounties. You can find them at Mounties Band on Facebook and Twitter. And you can find them at Mounties. Well, let's just say if you're on a website that's actually about the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, you've gone the wrong way. But either way, they're out there, and they're not difficult to remember. Plus, I love their merch. Saw they have the Joy Division design shirt at the show, as well as the shirt with Morrissey on it. Fantastic. I love when merch looks like that. So that about wraps it up for the week this week. I want to say thank you to everyone for tuning in. Yes, I know that this week was supposed to be an episode with Johnny Sizzle, and we will record an episode together, he and I, in the future. We had some complications come up that caused us to take a rain check on it, so that's why I'm putting the Hawksley Workman episode out earlier than I'd anticipated. But thank you so much for tuning in to this week's show. If you want to follow us online, we are at TSA Pod on Twitter. I'm at Mr. Matt Moskal on Twitter. You can send us an email if you have any comments, questions, concerns about the program at tsapodcast@gmail.com. You can check out our website, www.thesupportingact.com.
for more content. And on top of that as well, if you like the show, please subscribe to us on iTunes and help us climb the charts, as well as leave some comments, some stars, some constructive criticism if you have any. But thank you for listening to this show long enough to hear this portion, I guess, is what I should really be saying. All right. Well, it's almost Christmas. It's almost the holiday season, they say. So I'm just getting my mind around that right now. And, you know, it doesn't look like Christmas in Winnipeg. It looks like a poster for a horror movie, all foggy and wet. It's not disappointing, though. I'd rather have this than the alternative of frozen and difficult to traverse, really. So I'm pretty happy about that. Yeah, life could be worse. Life could be so much worse. All right. So our theme music is performed by Tyson Brinacombe. He also performs our interstitial music. You can check out his latest record, Casio Fiasco, on labelfantastic.com. And the music you're hearing behind you right now is the band NASA, a local Winnipeg band. Their latest record is called Losing Weight, but this song is from their Troubled Heart EP. Both albums are available on Bandcamp if you want to download them and send the money right to the band. They would greatly appreciate that. If you want to check out my conversation with Dave Todd from NASA, I believe it's episode number 16. So, right before Nick Thorburn from Islands. Just go back and enjoy some of our previous episodes if this is your first time listening. Because there's some fun stuff in there, I swear. Alright. Well, I guess there isn't too much else to say here, so thank you so much for tuning in. I've been Matt Moskal. Remember, you've got to support your local everything, and everybody's got to open for somebody sometime, am I right? Yeah, I probably am. Cheers! And you have yourselves a joyous December. Whatever that might mean to you.
Thanks for seeing me. I'm here because I'm thinking of doing some comedy.
Oh, right, like a comedy movie.
No, on stage. Stand-up comedy, live comedy of some kind.
Wow.
I'm a funny guy, aren't I? I'm funny, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Here's some of the stuff I'd like to work on. Improv, stand-up comedy, funny monologues, crazy characters, sketches, slapstick, anecdotes, parody. Yeah?
Yeah.
There. You notice this list, huh? I'm always making lists.
Oh.
In fact, that's probably why Steven Spielberg cast me as Oscar Schindler's List. I said, Steven, I make lists all the time. And he said, that's exactly what I'm looking for. What's funny?
So I thought you were joking about getting the part of Oscar Schindler because you made lists.
No. As an actor, you need stuff to draw on. And I drew on that.
Okay. Wow.
Okay, let's do some improvisational comedy.
I can't now, Liam.
It's a bad time.
Let's do some improvisational comedy. Now.
Okay.
Give us a scenario.
Right, okay. You're a hypochondriac and Ricky's a doctor.
Excellent. It's okay. Knock, knock.
Come in.
Hello.
Oh, no, not you again.
I've never been here before.
Sorry, I thought, because you're a hypochondriac, you would have been to the doctors before.
Don't presume. That's a backstory we didn't agree on beforehand.
No, I know. That's improv, though, isn't it? You sort of go with the flow.
I don't take notes.
Okay.
Can we go again?
Yep.
Because you ruined that.
Sorry.
Knock, knock.
Come in.
Hey.
Hi, how's it going? What seems to be the problem?
I've contracted AIDS.
How did you get that?
From an African prostitute. I'm riddled with it. the prostitutes from an African country that's ravaged by starvation. So selling her body was the only financial recourse she had left.
Do you mind if I interject for a second, sir? I just think this is getting quite heavy, this sketch, and I just wonder if perhaps, just for the sake of comedy, you might not want to have contracted AIDS from an African prostitute. Just.
Uh-huh.